7th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we're back again with another adventure with Sherlock Holmes. This one, The Dancing Men. This one, finally, Chip, we have a story about Chicago.
We do. And we also have a story with pictures, Steve. That really helps me out a lot.
And aren't those dancing men? They're so cute, right? I love the pictures in this one.
They are adorable. This is a cipher. This is a code that we have to figure out as readers, or wait for Sherlock Holmes to explain it to us.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I did. So tell me, what's going on in Chicago at this time?
All right, so we've got two areas that we wanted to discuss. One is around the time that the Sherlock Holmes stories take place. And we know that's going to be, you know, 1893, 1894, 1895, somewhere around there when he is, you know, the Sherlock Holmes we know. And the World Columbian Exposition is taking place in Chicago. There's going to be our connection of what that, and that happens in 1893. And that was celebrating the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival in the New World in 1492, which certainly is very interesting considering every Columbus Day there seems to be some kind of protest going on. And because this is such a important event that happens in the city of Chicago, this is one of the stars on the Chicago flag. And Pam, you're not from Chicago area. Are you familiar with the Chicago flag at all?
I am not.
It is the best flag ever.
Well, it's such a iconic symbol that, you know, when many people pass away, particularly in a line of service, if they're a policeman or a fireman or something of that nature, you know, they can choose the American flag. Many people could choose the Illinois flag. People in Chicago choose the Chicago flag. It really is very iconic. And any municipality that's looking at creating a flag should probably look at the simple design of this flag and how much it identifies with the people of the area.
And the history.
Oh, yes, and the history. We also want to note that during this World's Fair that took place in Chicago in 1893, there was a serial killer running around. They didn't really know it at the time, but they think that that gentleman, at some point over his term, not just in Chicago, but other areas too, had killed around 200 people.
Whoa.
Yeah, so I'm telling you, there's... Steve and I have this book that we're like, yeah, we're going to read this book. We haven't read it yet. But
The Devil in the White City. And yes, we need to read and discuss that. And I think we need to fold Pam into that conversation.
It's actually, it's on my to-read list too, and I have not yet read that. So maybe we should make a commitment to read that book.
Maybe later.
Yes.
Yes. So much of our modern world was introduced during this fair.
Yeah. It is pivotal in the history of technology and industry. There are so many things that were invented and displayed during the World's Columbian Exposition. It is stunning sometimes to list all of them.
And wait a minute. Was this Chicago murderer, the serial killer, was his name Holmes?
Yes.
He used the name Holmes as his disguise name.
Oh, my goodness.
His name was actually Herman Mudgett, okay. But yes, he went by H.H. Holmes.
That's crazy. Okay.
Interesting choice.
Sherlock was known for quite a few disguises. We don't know if it was real or not. That was a joke. All right, so the Sherlock Holmes takes place in 1894. 1895 at that time, but the publication was 1903. So what was going on with Doyle? What may have inspired him to use Chicago as a connection to this story? Well, it could be that, mob violence was just starting at that time, and the mafia was in, and there was a guy named Diamond Jim, and he was one of the first people to build this crime empire based on prostitution, gambling, and racketeering. From 1902 and to his death in 1920, And there is a connection with him, you know, concerning his murder that could be with Al Capone. So I've heard about that guy too.
Oh, interesting.
So Chicago crime.
Suffice it to say, yeah, Chicago is equated to crime. If you go to Japan and say you're from Chicago, the right. usual response is, oh, gangsta, bang, bang. Oh, okay, that's all we know about Chicago.
Well, anyway, Chicago was a major city at the time. And so that's enough little background to get started into our story.
I like that. Okay, thank you. And it's so fun that you guys are right there in Chicago.
Yep.
So this one starts with a really typical opening. I feel like this story is getting us right in the comfort zone of our Sherlock Holmes stories. So I like the start. Holmes had been seated for some hours in silence, with his long, thin back curved over a chemical vessel in which he was brewing a particularly malodorous product. His head was sunk upon his breast, and he looked from my point of view like a strange, lank bird with dull gray plumage and a black topknot. So here again, we have animal imagery associated with Sherlock Holmes. We've often seen him connected to a bloodhound. And here we have that sort of, you know, how does that impact you guys, connecting him to this strange, lank bird?
It's certainly something that I think is in the mind of Doyle when he's describing faces. He's always talking about the noses of people, his characters in his stories. And I think that there is a direct connection between the beak of a bird and those descriptions often. So I can see his viewpoint here, where he is making the allusion to a bird-like creature with his thinness after being away for so long.
Well, and I really like that, because my first thought is like connecting Sherlock to animals really speaks to the fact that Sherlock is both super rational and has all these really strong instincts. But I think you're totally right as well that Doyle does rely on animals for his imagery and for his descriptions. He's so good at describing characters, at describing what people look like. And so, yeah, I like that. I think both of those things are happening here.
He shocks Watson with his comment, "So, Watson," said he suddenly, "you do not propose to invest in South African securities." Like, that came out of absolutely nowhere here, right?
And of course, Watson was sitting there thinking, should I or should I not invest in South African securities? But he hasn't said a word. And it's so great because Watson says, "No, no, 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 you cannot know that." And Holmes says, "Well, let me explain. You're going to say that this is so simple in just a few minutes." Jack, that is exactly what happens.
What was also crazy about that is Watson's checkbook is locked up in Holmes' drawer. Very like, listen, if you want access to your money, you let me know.
That was a very interesting detail, wasn't it? Like, how did that happen? Was that Holmes's idea, or was that Watson's idea to keep him from his wild spending habits that we have not seen any evidence of in the past?
Well, you know, sell your medical practice. Move back home and put your checkbook in this drawer over here. I'll lock this up for you.
Interesting detail.
Now, in this story, we have, what is this, our fourth, fifth American woman who has a secret. So I was just thinking, as I was reading this, I was thinking about the other American women we've seen in the canon so far. And as I mentioned to you guys, I'm kind of thinking about maybe doing a little research and maybe writing a paper on Doyle's American women. They're so interesting. So obviously we had Irene Adler from New Jersey in The Scandal in Bohemia, and she has her own set of secrets, a very strong woman. And then we have Hattie Duran from San Francisco and various mining towns in The Noble Bachelor. Did she have any connections, do you think, with Elsie in this story?
The idea of somebody who has a secret is certainly there. I don't know what other what other connections you're implying, though. You tell me. You're smarter.
She had the American suitor, right? Now, it's kind of the opposite. Her situation is the opposite of Elsie's, in that she was really, really in love with her American guy. And then she thought he had died. And he reappears right at the day of her wedding.
And so the reappearance of a former romantic partner. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also her father, right? I think Hattie Duran's father was maybe, I don't know, was he a bit suspect? Perhaps not.
You're asking me to remember something from how many weeks ago?
I know. I should have looked it up. Forgive me.
What day is it now? I don't know.
I know.
I'm not helping you with your paper. You write your own paper, Pam.
Well, I think you hit something there, though. Your pride. We have the other two that we have listed here.
Well, we have Effie, who's from Atlanta in the yellow face, right? And she was the one that reminded me the most of Elsie Patrick here. Because remember, she also was in England and refused to tell her husband, Mr. Grant Munro, about her past and said, don't ask me any questions. And, you know, my money is my own. And Grant Munro, very much like Mr. Cubitt, was very respectful of his wife's privacy. And so the dynamic between them seemed very similar to me.
Sure.
Yeah, these are very similar stories in that respect. This is a wife from America who has a secret and a very loving husband who is very respectful of that secret, but at the same time is very worried for the well-being of his loving wife.
In fact, they're almost the same.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting that Mr. Cubitt comes to Sherlock's office and Sherlock is like, why don't you just ask your wife? And he's like, no, I promised I wouldn't ask. So instead, I'm going to ask you to violate her privacy on my behalf. Like, there's something a little awkward about it. But yes, he's doing it out of total concern for his wife and his wife's safety, of course.
Well, of course, British people are like that, right? Especially with Americans.
So most of this adventure takes place in Holmes's rooms, and we have the idea of the armchair detective for the most part. He figures almost all of it out before he actually leaves in a real rush. He really feels that there is something awful that's about to happen and rushes out, and he gets there just a little bit too late, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, isn't it interesting that at the Norfolk Constabulary, the police are totally on board with Holmes. So we've seen this huge shift, right, since those early stories when Holmes and Lestrade were kind of at odds with each other. Here, Inspector Martin is super happy to see Holmes. He says, I should be proud to feel that we were acting together, Mr. Holmes, said the inspector earnestly. And then the inspector and also the doctor, they watch with enthusiasm and interest as Holmes does his forensic analysis of the scene. Capital, cried the inspector. Capital. They're just watching master detective at work. So now his reputation, as we're here in like the 26th story, it totally precedes him. And I thought it was interesting that Holmes kind of took control of the scene, right? He gives all the orders. You go to this neighboring home, here's like message, send it, you send a telegram. And then he gathers the inspector, the doctor, and Watson, and he's like, I'll explain everything. And I love how he does give his friend Watson a little nod. He says, as to you, friend Watson, I owe you every atonement for having allowed your natural curiosity to remain so long unsatisfied. To you, Inspector, the whole incident may appeal as a remarkable professional study. And that's when he explains the cipher.
And the whole time that he hasn't been sharing with Watson, Watson has been very patiently waiting. He does not say, I was worried, I was concerned. He's just patiently relaying the story to us.
I think you hit on something there also, that the earlier short stories that we were reading, Holmes is a much younger detective, looked at with skepticism and being challenged somewhere. And now he is, you know, I am a respected person. They know who I am.
Right. And so
they respect what I bring to the table.
Exactly. And that's partly because he's solved so many cases. It's partly because Watson has written up his cases for the public. And that often happens, you know, people often reference that in the stories. It's also because forensic science is now a respected and growing field. by the turn of the century compared to where it was even in the 1880s, right? We do get mention of Bertillon, who did all of that work in France, and we have much more of a feeling of fingerprinting, of forensic analysis. So he was initially working in a sort of unknown science. Now he's right in it. And also, it seems like Holmes always mentions these little monographs that he's been writing. And so he wrote a monograph on cryptography.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. To join his, we should make a list of all his monographs. The one on cigarette ash.
That was a long study, that right. one. So we get finally to the cipher here. This is the most fun of this adventure. The idea of a secret language that this man brings to Holmes, these images, these dancing men, these tiny little stick figures that are adorable, and they certainly mean something. And as readers, we are working, just like Watson, at what does this mean? We know that it means something, but we have to try to work it out.
Hey, Pat St. Jack, I'd like to buy an E.
Now, it strikes me that Sherlock Holmes would be very good at Scrabble, because he has in his mind, he has like, obviously the E is the most common letter, but then he says like, these are the next two most common, then this, then this, then this. He's got it all worked out, how you figure out a cipher. And so each of these cute little dancing guys represents one letter of the alphabet. And if they're holding a flag, that represents punctuation. I love it. The English teacher in me is so happy about this little cipher.
And the coding teacher in me is so yes. happy about the idea of using code to make things happen. Right. When I teach computers, I start with the idea of code. Mm-hmm. We're going to speak a different language. We're going to have to maintain a different way of communicating in order to make these things happen.
And let's note that for our readers who are reading the text, that you do have these drawings inside your book.
Yes.
And for listeners, obviously, they can't do that.
There's no description in the audiobook of this. I don't know what it would be. Giant eye, man doing this.
Now, I did listen to the audiobook as well as read a hard copy. And I mean, the narrator did a great job, but you just can't. You just can't show how cute the little guys are. So.
This is the fun cipher of the week. I think that I could make some t-shirts with some of these figures and have some
t-shirt.
Interesting messages.
Yes. And there's our story, our homework for all of our listeners to write us a letter in these dancing characters.
That's good. I like that.
I have included a link to a cipher that can do that for you. The encoding and decoding is right there in our show notes, and we would love to see those notes.
That's a great idea. Write a message for the t-shirt.
Right. What would your t-shirt say? What would you walk around with a message in a cipher?
I'd like to solve the puzzle.
I am intrigued what our audience is going to come up with for this. Because voter told me to. Yes. This is your homework assignment for the day. We get to the ending of the story, and we have an epilogue this time.
Well, and this is super interesting because this, my friends, is a total dime novel ending. Let me read it to you and then I'll explain. So the ending is only one word of epilogue, which isn't quite true. The American, Abe Slaney, was condemned to death at the Winter Assize at Norwich, but his penalty was changed to penal servitude, consideration of mitigating circumstances, and the certainty that Hilton Cubitt had fired the first shot. Of Mrs. Hilton Cubitt, I only know that I have heard she recovered entirely and that she still remains a widow, devoting her whole life to the care of the poor and to the administration of her husband's estate. The end. Now, we have not seen this kind of ending before, but this, my friends, is exactly how every detective dime novel ends from like 1860 through 1917. There's this whole story, and then there's that extra little chapter, and it's often called epilogue, in which they say, here's what happened to every character of importance that you met in this novel. And so you start, and even the order is the same. You actually start with the criminal. Here was the criminal's punishment. And if there was mitigation, you explain that. And then you go to the victim. And in this case, always the person's situation is just. And so in this case, Mrs. Hilton Cubitt, she does recover. So that was okay. But now she doesn't remarry or do anything like that. She devotes her life to care of the poor and administering her husband's estate, because of course it is her fault in this odd way that he is dead. So she is responsible for continuing his good work as the squire in his area. And then normally in a dime novel, the very last line would tell you what the detective is now doing. But this is a Sherlock Holmes story, so we don't really need that, because we're going to see Sherlock again next month in the next installment.
And Inspector Blutarsky became a senator, right?
I was going to say, and this is the part where we talk about communication and how important that is for a couple. And yeah,
right.
He probably wouldn't be dead right now if for some reason they could somehow communicate what was really going on.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is I just love that in this story with like the American character, he actually goes to this American form of the dime novel ending that's so consistent with all the dime novels that I read when I wrote my dissertation on that topic. It's just so
fucking.
So
I'm wondering if he's just playing with the format then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he knows they all end this way, he's going to be like, "All right, so we're going to use it."
And when he says only one word of epilogue, I definitely believe that's what he's doing, because that's exactly the ending of every dime novel. Epilogue. Here we go.
Joe's like, how American.
Right. Playing with that American idea, uh-huh. Taking these American characters, the British viewpoint, the perspective of who these Americans are. Of course they're gangsters from Chicago, because what else would they be?
Right.
And here's the way this kind of story would end. I look forward to your paper about the American women, because I think your sense of this is amazing, Pam. Your perspective on what we're seeing is enlightening.
Well, and as is yours, you guys. I mean, this has been such a fun, we each bring such a different element to reading these stories. So this has been so much fun. And, you know, I personally, you know, I'm a tenured professor at a major research university, but I really believe in public scholarship. I believe in the idea of people getting together in library book groups, in random podcasts, in all kinds of places where we actually talk about the same text from different perspectives. And I think this has been so much fun for me, but also so good for my scholarship.
This is the best thing we've done all month.
Well, if there was just something to slow life down for us, Steve, to force us to, you know, spend time in solitude and contemplating different ideas.
It's like college all over again.
Oh, it's a blessing. It's a blessing. So, Steve, as our listeners send us letters asking or basically answering the question, what makes Sherlock Holmes the most popular detective? They can certainly now do it in pictures.
Make sure you tag it with the hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Put it all over the social medias, and we'll be happy to see your messages. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, send us a voicemail, and tell us how you're enjoying all this. Are you getting a scholarship out of this as well? Are you going to be writing a paper like Pam, or not doing so like me and Chip? That's fine. We would love to hear from you. We've got another short story coming up tomorrow, The Adventure of the Solitary Cyclist. That's intriguing. We'll see what that comes up with tomorrow. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
We'll see you in the future.